Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Last episode, we spent some time with a member of my home fellowship who does some great work in a minimum security prison here in New Mexico, even taking prisoners out to participate in our convention. This time we talked to a member from Dave's home fellowship, who has spent the past 33 years steadily bringing the NA message into a maximum security prison in the Philadelphia area. Perhaps we could divide the discipline of hospitals and institutions in NA into two broad categories. One method is the panel presentation, a speaker meeting in which NA members come into institutions to carry our message of hope. The other method is the institutional group, in which NA members from the outside help create and facilitate a regular meeting on the inside. In this method, while there may be outside speakers, the inmates themselves also share and do service as members of the group. Some H&I efforts are a combination of both. Pete, whom you'll meet in a minute, has been going into this maximum security prison for all these years to facilitate an institutional group, which includes members serving long sentences and even life. Some of the lifers, as you will hear, have decades clean themselves and perform some amazing service in there, both within NA and in other ways. Jimmy from our last episode and Pete from this one both stressed that this isn't about them. It's about the addicts they work with and about the many thousands of members like them who do this service all over the world. For Dave and me, it's about both, really. We're proud to call these guys friends and moved by the steady, committed service they do. With that, we give you Pete.
Okay, just a little background, Pete. Petey is an old friend of mine that right now is probably a couple of miles from where I am. So why don't you, you know, we always like to start off, tell us where you first heard about Narcotics Anonymous. Where were you when you got the message?
I was actually in Florida. I had ran an automobile into a police car, and the judge made me go to some meetings. It was about a year before I got clean. And at those meetings, they were AA, but there were some people there from NA, and they invited me to some NA meetings. But I was getting high out in the parking lot before I would go into the meeting. And so, of course, it didn't work for me. About a year later, I was doing a geographical cure with my, you know, I went down to see my dad. That's how I ended up in Florida. And then I came back up here, and I ended up getting really strung out bad, and I was... I was sleeping on a park bench down in Needle Park, McPherson Square in Kensington. And, you know, things were really bad. My sisters finally found me. I had left my son on my mother's doorstep because I was going to do a burglary. And so that's where my life was at. I was living in the park, actually. And my sisters found me, convinced me to go to Eagleville Hospital. And when I was in Eagleville Hospital, I remember crying outside to my sister saying, I'm never going to do this again. But as soon as I got inside, I was buying the Valiums off the other patients. So with the money they gave me to call home to check on my son. So they started bringing some meetings in there. And I would go up to the guy after the meeting. I remember going up and I would say, can I see your tracks? Because at this time I was in my jugular veins and I didn't believe that anybody got clean. I had been shooting dope since I was in the Marine Corps, and I just didn't believe anybody ever stopped that was like me, that stole every day and all that kind of stuff. So these guys would roll up their sleeves and let me look at their tracks, and I would like stick my finger in them like Doubting Thomas in the Bible. So I got out of there. They made me wait 10 days for a bed day in Eagleville. And at this point, I didn't want to use anymore, but I used every one of those 10 days. Finally, on July 7th, 1981, my sisters grabbed me before I could go out and use anything, and they took me to Eagleville. You know, once they got me signed in, I had a set of works in my back pocket just in case things didn't work out. I used to carry my works wrapped up in a handkerchief. And I went outside, and I threw them in the trash can and outside of admissions, and I just looked up. I said, please God help me. And that's where it began. So in there, I started going to the meetings. They had meetings there pretty much every day except Saturday night. And then some volunteer would take us out on Saturday nights. So I went to meetings pretty much every day. And that was the beginning. And then when I got out of there, I started going back there every Sunday night. We would go back there and we would just take the AA stuff and we would cross out AA because we didn't have any books yet. And we would just, you know, write in NA or, you know, say drugs instead of alcohol. And so I started carrying the commitment back there right away as soon as I got out of treatment. I went to a halfway house. I was in there 7.5 months and I went to a halfway house for 6 months. And those same guys, Charlie, Nunzio, they would pick us up at the halfway house and take us to meetings. And there were only a couple of NA meetings around. So same thing, I would go to both fellowships and, you know, and there were people there that I'm sure didn't want us there, but there were also a lot of good men, old men who reached out to us and took us under their wing, which I really appreciate. They would take me to the diner and things like that, and I couldn't even talk. All I could think in my head was, I can't wait to get to back to the halfway house. You know, just get me out of here. People would be talking and laughing. And, you know, I was like socially retarded. I couldn't carry on a conversation at all. So anyway, I got out. I finally got out of the halfway house. I brought my son up to live, you know, I got my son back and brought him up with me before I got my daughter back. And then I got a little apartment on Marshall Street. And somewhere in that, between my first and second year, a fellow named Joe R., took me up to Graterford on a commitment.
And when you say Graterford, Graterford is a state correctional facility.
Graterford is a state correctional facility.
Right. And it's a maximum security facility about 8-9 miles from Norristown, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so go ahead.
So he took me up there on a commitment, and first time I was, you know, uncomfortable just going into that environment. The first time I was in jail, I was 14 years old for burglary. So I wasn't comfortable, but, you know, I got through that. And then I went up a couple times with him, and then he dropped out. But anyway, I just started going. Then my friend Kurt started coming up with me, Kurt E., and we just started doing that commitment like every week, 2 meetings a week there.
When you say a commitment, can you describe what that is?
Well, we took the commitment to do the run the Narcotics Anonymous meetings in Graterford. They had AA, and then that fellow Joe and a couple of other people, Bobby B., they approached Graterford and asked if they could start an NA meeting.
So when you say start an NA meeting, are you talking about like an institutional group, or are you talking about going in there with HNI panel presentations, or what was the nature of the meeting?
There was no panel presentations at the time. They would let us bring people in there the same day. We could call up and bring somebody in the same day. We would just take in speakers, NA speakers.
Okay.
One of us would chair, and then we would bring in speakers every week, and a different speaker would come in from the community, from the NA community.
Did the inmates share too, or was it? Were they...
The inmates, in the beginning, it was really tough. You would have to go around the room and say, how about you? Would you like to say something? What about you? Because they felt like taking part in that was kind of like made them like a chump, or being a part of that thing that, you know, they rebelled against the authority thing. So it was difficult in the beginning to get them to participate, but I would just keep asking them, you know, well, how about you? What about you? Don't you have anything to say? Most of them would be short, or some of them just wouldn't share at all. But there was always, like everywhere, there's always a couple of guys that would overcome their fear and they would start sharing. And then, so that took a little while before they got comfortable. And then once they got comfortable, it became like they would talk about anything, talk about being molested when they were kids. One guy would share about being molested. Five other guys in the meeting would share the same information. It just kind of took off and took on a life of its own. You know, you could feel God's presence in there. That's one thing I always do. I always pray for God's spirit, you know, his spirit to fill the room and to fill their hearts and, you know, let us all say something that helps us, helps each other, and pleases him. You know, that's the prayer I always say before the meetings.
Let me ask you a couple questions, Pete. There was really no formalized training to go into a facility at that time, correct?
No, there really wasn't an area. They were just, some guys met at some people's houses, like Joe, Kurt, Nunzio, a couple of them met at some places, but I really wasn't involved in that. And there were just a couple of people that did that. We just took the commitment and that was it. Joe went in and then he got me in there and then I just kept going. That's all. And I didn't get involved in H&I and the committee for some years later. And then I chaired for a couple of years and then I stepped down. So other people could get involved, you know.
Okay. Now, as far as getting clearance to go into the facility, was there any formality to that?
Well, the coincidence was is that there was a fellow who was working in treatment at the time, this fellow David. He actually went on through treatment and became the warden of that prison, which was great for me because he remembered me. He was a counselor down on Girard Avenue when I was still on the street. And he knew my name and he remembered me when I would call up there and give the names who was going to come in. He started talking to me about that experience that he knew me from the outside. He became the warden and he was just so involved in that, in the treatment aspect of it. Like he saw the value of it.
Oh, wow. That's pretty darn fortunate to have an ally like that.
Yeah. Yeah. He was wonderful. He really was. He really supported us. We had, at one point, they ended up taking it away from us, but at one point, he let them take over the whole dock area, and they cleaned out this old gigantic storage room, and we would have sometimes 100, 150 guys in there on a Friday night. They cleaned the place out. They painted the steps on the walls in like calligraphy. They did such a beautiful job. They would meet in the mornings there and do like a reading, a meditation, and do a prayer together. And then they would go about their day. And then they let them come back and they let us have that storeroom for a lot of years. They let us do it. And then they got a new deputy in, a security deputy, kind of got more control because they had a big drug bust. And then after that, they kind of gave the big area back to the guards and let the guards have that for their own whatever they were doing in there. But they took it away from us. So then they moved us all into treatment. But then that, you know, that worked out too. We ended up getting a Spanish meeting started, Spanish speaking meeting, because at the time they gave them no treatment. So we were, if a guy came up for treat or for parole, the only treatment they were giving them were the meetings. So if there were Spanish people in the prison who couldn't speak any English, they weren't making parole because they couldn't get, they had no treatment to get parole. So some of the Spanish guys approached us that spoke English, that came to our meetings, and they on their own, they copied the white book into mimeographed sheets and they translated it into Spanish. At the time we tried to get some stuff from World, but they didn't have Spanish literature either. So the guys just did it on their own. And then I would just go and sit in there. That was another night of the week that we would go. And I would just go in and just sit there. And it's amazing because I got the same exact feeling every time I ever went to that meeting. And I wouldn't understand 90% of what was said in there. But I came out with the same feeling. Sometimes I leave Graterford and I start to cry, you know. I start to well up because even times when I've had some real bad health problems and I'll go in there and I'm so sick and on, you know, hours before that, I'm like saying, God, just get me there, you know, like, and then on the way up, it's like your words, not mine. I feel so dark inside. I don't feel like I have anything to share with anybody. And then I get there and when I leave there, I'm not even sick anymore. You know, I have some issues from being shot when I was younger and all. And sometimes that stuff doesn't work, those exchanges, and I get very ill. And I just, it's amazing the effect it has on me. And like I said, I would get that same effect out of the Spanish meeting, even though I didn't understand anything. And then we got some Spanish people moved into the area, and they kind of took it over.
So before the basic text comes out, you're using the little white book in there?
That's correct.
Okay, and the guys on their own translate the little white book into Spanish, and around that, they start a Spanish-speaking Narcotics Anonymous meeting before there's even a basic text.
Yep.
That's unbelievable. That's crazy.
Yeah, the fellow's name was Indio, actually. He was one of the guys. There was a couple of them. But they were coming to our meetings because they could speak English. And then, but they felt, you know, they felt an obligation to their friends who couldn't speak any English.
That's, now, Ron, how's that for an early translation?
That's really something. Do you have, does anybody have that early, those translations, that material?
I don't know if they would, because they translated them, they let them copy them inside the prison, and they handed them out to the prisoners. I wouldn't have had a copy of it because it was in Spanish. They only did it for their guys.
You know, as we talk to people who were doing service back at that time, there's a couple of things that really stick out. This is kind of a new one, but I bet you it's not unique. People coming up with their own Spanish translations because there weren't any official ones. But another thing is, you know, the thing you said about earlier than that, changing some of the literature from the AA literature and scratching out alcoholic, putting addicts, scratching out alcohol and putting drugs. This is another thing we just keep hearing, that people were so hungry to get the message to addicts that that was a method that a lot of people were using.
Yeah, that's all we really had. Mm-hmm. That was the only step books we had. Those were the only things we had. And you know, I'm grateful that I was exposed to a lot of that, because there was a lot of things in there that when they started coming out with our books, they said the same kind of things, where if you don't do this step, you in there they would say you're going to drink again. But in our book, it says, if you don't do this, particularly in the fifth step, it says in the basic text, and now in the fourth step in the green book, it does the same thing. It just says, if you don't do this step, the insanity returns and you use again.
Yeah.
You know? And one of the great lines that I always use, I do another step meeting at Montgomery County Prison, which I've been involved in off and on for the last almost 30 years. But in there we, cause it's the same, you know, it's a more transient group. So we just read a step out of the basic text and then we discuss it, cause the basic text, because it's a shorter version. So it gives the guys more time to share. And then we read it. And then, one of the great things, the first line in the 10th step in the basic text says, that if you don't stay on top of your character defects, they lead you back into a corner that you can't get out of clean. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite lines in all the literature I've ever read.
That's a great
line. I've read all that other stuff too, you know. It's one of the best meetings that I've ever attended in NA, this basic tech step group. It's just unbelievable the things these guys share about their lives. For instance, I was up Greaterford on Friday night, and a guy I met in Montgomery County Prison over a year ago, he got sentenced and sent up to Greaterford. Since he's been at Greaterford, he came to the meetings there, and he got involved in that step meeting and started cheering. So when he went up there, he started coming to the meetings up there. While he's been in Greaterford, his son and his daughter were killed in an automobile accident. His son was killed. He died within a week after the accident in December. And then his daughter has been on life support. She just died on March the 4th. He's been hiding in his cell for the last couple of weeks. So keep him in your prayers. His name is Chris. He just came back to the meetings. And to hear the other guys share with him, you know, and they're like Muslim and Christian and all different denominations, but the Muslim guy sharing that, you know, we all have different beliefs, We all believe in different things, but you know what? At the bottom of it all, we're all addicts, and we're your brothers. Like, we're here for you. You know, you can come to my cell anytime. You can talk to me anytime. It's a powerful thing. That's all I can say.
Yeah, again, it's a Greaterford's maximum security. The Montgomery County Correctional Facility you mentioned is it's a county facility with pretrial detainees and people right. who are doing short county sentences, relatively short sentences.
Right.
But do you have lifers in your group up at Greaterford?
Oh, yes, we do. Sure. That's one of the things that they do with some of the lifers is they actually turn them into peer counselors. And they let them work within the facility with other, they do drug intakes and things like that. They work in the office, in the treatment office. And they get to work with other inmates. And a lot of those guys are lifers that have been through our groups, you know, coming to our NA meetings. And they just carry it on, you know. They become very important in those guys' lives. One of the great things, there were some guys in there that some of the lifers or some of the – well, the guys that die in there. My last partner, when I was a burglar, got the case the same year that I got clean. He got within a couple months, he got a case where he was outside in the car and a guy got killed on a drug deal that went bad. And he wouldn't tell any other guys. He got life without parole. And I used to see him at those meetings, you know, near the end of his life, he had the Forrest Gump braces and all that kind of stuff. The other prisoners used to have to push him from behind up the steps and up the ramps to get him into the meetings. And he died, you know, several years ago. He had a muscular disease and he ended up passing away. But if I could give anybody anything, my second sponsor used to say, this fellow James, he was in Greaterford for 11 years. He used to say, I wish I had a zipper on my chest and I could open it up and let people see how recovery feels. If I could, they would never want to use again. Mm. That's why I asked him to be my sponsor. Wish people could see. I wish people could come with me. I wish people could feel what I feel in those meetings. If I could give a gift, the gift to anybody that I love, it would be service in that situation, to be involved in that. If they could just see how it feels to come out of there, to connect with those guys on that level, they would never want to use again. And that's one of the things. I used to struggle mightily with obsessions in the beginning. I mean, like I said, I was shooting dope in my jugular veins. It was almost constant thoughts of that stuff or stealing, you know. If I went past an empty house, I'd think of doing a burger. If I went into a store, I'd think about boosting and returning. Like, everything was overwhelming. When I started doing the prison, I don't know exactly when the obsession was taken away. It wasn't like every day by that point, but it was somewhere between my first and second year. Since I got involved in service with the prisons, I've never, ever, ever had a thought about using. And I hear people with a lot of years that say, you know, oh, you're an addict. You're always going to think about using. That's baloney. I never think about using. You know, I go to the VA hospital. They try to give me narcotics. I tell them, you know, they say, you got to get your priorities in order. I tell them, I already have my priorities in order. I don't want anything to block off my relationship with God. You know, so I take ibuprofen and aspirin, but they try to give it to me. When I used to go to a doctor's office, the whole time I was in there, I was looking. I know you know how that feels. I was looking for works. I was looking for something that they might have made a mistake or a prescription pad that they might have forgotten to walk out of the room with. You know, I go in there all the time. I have a port in my chest now where I have an access line all the time. When I was in my addiction, I used to pray for something like that. Like, if I could just have a line like that, and have everything I ever want. Like, if I had a little bit of cancer where I could get all the Deloitte I'd ever want, but I wouldn't die. You know, it was just enough cancer to get me all the Deloitte I wanted. And I had an IV line like I have now in my chest. I have a permanent port in my chest, which I've had over 20 some years in my chest. And I never think about it. I read one time in one of the meditation books, it said the goal of recovery is you could be on a desert island and have everything you would ever want to use, and you would never touch it because it would change something that's happened inside your heart. And that's how I feel. And I know the prison is a big part of that. It's always been that. It carried me through my illnesses. It carried me through my divorce. It carried me through when I didn't have my children the first year after my divorce. You know, I got through that time. I ended up a year later with all my kids living with me. You know, the judge gave me custody of my children, even with my record and the way that I had lived all those years. You know, because I had changed. I was a different person, and they recognized that in me.
All right, I want to ask you about September of 2013. The World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous is coming to Philadelphia, and you hear about the Unity Day. Tell us about that.
Well, I was there Friday night with the guys. We were preparing for our regular meeting on Friday night. We were preparing, setting it up with the staff and trying to get the remote set up and all that. And then, so I didn't actually get to the World Convention because I wanted to be with those guys. And then Sunday, they brought us down, and we're in like the basement of the prison, which is like the belly of the beast. And I'm sitting in a room with a bunch of guys. They gave us some bag lunches, which was a big treat for them, you know, like chocolate milk and some cheese sandwiches, you know, American cheese sandwiches. And anyway, we're sitting around in this room, and they had the remote hooked up. So they let two of the guys like do the remote, and the guys, as the meeting was going on, they had it live going on a feed going into the room where I was at. And these guys were like screaming, and they were saying like, oh my God, because they went all around the world, and they were saying like, man, I thought this was like just around here. Like, I had no idea. This thing's like all over the world. They made a point, you know, of saying that there's a world office in Iran, you know, which was like blew us away. They went to different penitentiaries throughout the world. The thing I was saying earlier, there's a group of guys. There are some really, you know, in prison, you get some really devout born-again Christians. There's safety in those groups. You get some really devout Muslims who are, again, there's a lot of safety in those groups. Then you have your regular run-of-the-mill guys who have their own beliefs or whatever. But in this meeting, these guys were jumping up and down like kids. I mean, the excitement and the enthusiasm. They were literally jumping up and down on the feet. They couldn't stay in their seats. They were hugging each other. They were like, you know, like patting each other on the back. It was the most beautiful thing. It transcends all racial barriers, all religious barriers, all the things that separate us in the real world. Just NA just cut through all that stuff. That was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had in my life. Just to be a part of that, to see the love and the sharing between those guys, you know. And there's none of that stuff that goes on. Like, I know what they'll talk about their own faith sometimes and all that, but there's none of that, you know, separatism. It's just, like that guy said it on Friday night to that kid who lost his two children, you know. Like, at the bottom of it all, man, we may have different beliefs and all, but we're all addicts, you know, and that means we all share the same pain, and we all know that pain, and, you know, we love you, and we're here for you, you know. And not one guy said it. Well, the one guy said it who was a Muslim, but there were other guys in the room. They all said the same thing. You know, we're on the same block, man. Just come into my cell anytime you want. You know, just walk in if you're jammed up, and just come in and talk to me. You know?
So I don't see
that anywhere else, huh?
What? You've been doing Greaterford for 30 years, correct?
About 33 years, yeah.
33 years, every Friday night.
Well, not always Friday. It used to be Mondays, and we did Monday and Tuesdays. It was for a while. We did Tuesdays and Fridays. We did Mondays and Fridays. And then there used to be a meeting even during the day on Wednesdays at noon. We used to my boss used to let me take off to go do a meeting. It was on Wednesdays at noon. But the regular meeting, I guess, I guess, I don't know if we've always had a meeting on Friday night, but there were other nights as well during the week. So, but that's our main, that was the big meeting on Friday nights where we used to have like 100, 150 guys when we had that much space. Now they don't give us that kind of space. We have to have our meetings down in treatment.
Now, I know how close you get to some of the guys that you befriend in there. And have you had the experience of when they get out, you see them at meetings out in the community and they transition back to living a clean life on the street?
I had a guy that got out of there. You heard him speak at our meeting, at our own group.
Yeah.
He was in there. He got out of prison at 57 years old. He went to Philadelphia Community College. In his third year in school, he was working at a halfway house at night. But in his third year, he was in a psych class and he told his story. And last time he was in prison, he was in there for 15 years. He got shot by the police in the chest and he was actually dying in an alley. And somebody told on him, and that's how they found him. The police found him laying up in the alley. He would have bled to death. He gets out at 57 years old. He goes to Philadelphia Community College. In his third year, he tells his story. A guy comes up to him after me and said, "How would you like to come to work for Philadelphia Mental Health? We'll start you out at $35,000 a year." They put him to work. He had to extend his education an extra year. So he graduated college at 62 years old with a degree in human services, and he went to work for like the mental health people. Another one of my friends, you heard him share too, he did 17 years on a 34-year thing, and he got out, and he just died. He had about 25 years.
Wow.
During that time, he had his kidney taken out with kidney cancer. He lived a few more years, and he got brain cancer. Then I thought he was going to be dying then, but he didn't die then. I was his sponsor. He ended up living another, like, 3 or 4 more years. He just passed. Just several months ago, he passed away. That guy I was telling you about, the first guy with the college thing, he just got off parole. For the first time in 50 years, it was the first time he was off the books. And 2 years ago in October was the first time he'd gotten off of since he was a kid. He was in Eastern State Penitentiary in the late 60s. That was his first prison, and he spent most of his life incarcerated. You know our friend Benny, who did, I don't know, what, 25 or 30 years in prison. There's another guy. His twin daughters were killed, 17-year-old daughters were killed in an automobile accident while he was in prison by a drunk driver, another drunk driver. And he's got about 18 years now. He's 82 or 83 years old. He's a member of our home group. So it's the only thing that works, really. You know, they try to fight this. Some, not everybody, but the people who try to fight these situations, you know, giving these people treatment and all that kind of stuff, they don't deserve it all. They don't realize that these people are coming back into their communities. If you don't treat them while you have the opportunity, they're coming back untreated into your community as a violent offender, you know, and they're going to, and I'm not saying it's the cure-all or anything like that. Most of my people don't stay clean when they get out, but there's a lot of them that do. And that's, you know, that's the goal, is if you could just reach, you know, some of them, and then, you know, it just takes off. Like, I'm sure when they started 12-step programs, they couldn't have looked ahead and seen the impact it would have on all the millions and millions and millions of people that have helped over the years. It's the same thing with us now. You can't see what it's going to look like in 50 years from now. But I think it's really the only hope we have.
Yeah, it really points to the traditions. I was just thinking about that the other day, that the power of the traditions in preserving it for the next generations who are going to get to have it. There are a lot of people hearing this who are going to really relate to your experience, Pete. The experience that you were sharing about, I heard somebody say it one time, "I've never been to an unsuccessful H&I meeting. I stayed clean after every one."
And that's right.
Yeah, and I've had a real similar experience that didn't last nearly as long as yours, but early in my recovery, I got involved also in a weekly jail meeting that I just went in there every single week. And it was exactly as you described it, where, you know, in the early going, there was a lot of like a little too cool for school kind of stuff. Like who's going to share first. But then as soon as one guy opened up, then it started to be a safe place for people to open up and share. And my God, it's one thing to say what impact it might have had on them. It's another one to say what impact it had on me to have that in my life. Everything you said really touched me, and really, really, I've had that same kind of experience. But you've been at it for 34 years? 33 years. And so what's the longest relationship you've got in your life right now that started with somebody in that place?
Well, I've got lifers that are still in there doing life that I've known that have over 25 or almost 30 years clean. Still in there, and they're lifers, and some of them work. There's one guy, when you're a lifer, the noise is so ungodly, they can't stand the noise. After a while, it starts to drive them crazy. So they like this guy sleeps during the day. And what he does is at nighttime, he goes down the infirmary, which is like a dark, like a small room where they have these small cells with a metal bed and then like just a little thin mattress on top of that. And the whole room is probably like, 15 by 10 or whatever. And the guys that are dying down there, he goes down there and sits with them and does hospice with them. So he's one of our guys, and he does that, and he gets the rewards of helping these people pass over so they're not alone, these prisoners, when they die. He stays with them during the night, which is unbelievable. He's in there on a double homicide. Two guys came in to rob him when he was selling drugs, and he ended up killing the guys, getting the gun away from the guy and shooting him, and he ended up going to jail for the rest of his life. But that's what he does. He got clean, and now he does hospice and holds people's hands when they pass over into the other life. So anyway, this is something that I wrote. I write these letters to God all the time. It's one of the things that gets me through my thing. It's like when I used to write letters home from jail, I would write to my grandmother, it's not your fault, Grandma. She went to mass every morning at 5:30. I said, it's not you. It's just me. I don't know what's the matter with me. And I really didn't know what was the matter with me then, But so I write these letters to God. And whenever I have guys working on the second step, I always tell them I want them to write a letter to God every night for a week and then tell me who they feel God is, not who they know God is, but what do they feel God is at that point. So here's something. One night I was at Montgomery County Prison, the county prison, and there was a guy in there, this big, muscular guy with tattoos everywhere, tough-looking kid, and he started crying because he had just found out that his HIV had turned into full-blown AIDS that day. He'd been coming to our meetings, and the next day I couldn't get him out of my head. And I started thinking back of all these guys, like that, knowing that warden. That warden used to let me go down to the infirmary when some of the guys from our group would be dying. And he let me go to visit him. And I remember visiting this one guy in particular. He was suffocating from the liver, the fluids in his body, because they don't do transplants in there. And they don't give him they don't drain off the fluids and all. They let him suffocate, He couldn't get a hardship because of his crimes. He had like 65 to 130 years in there for a string of drugstore robberies. They gave him 5 years on each one of his crimes. So anyway, he was dying, and I went to see him, and he goes, I said, Tom, you're going to be all right, right? He goes, Pete, I know, with a big smile on his face, we're soldiers in the army of the Lord, man. He was one of those guys that worked as a peer counselor. And they used to call him St. Thomas because, like, he would buy commissary for new guys that would come back in from the neighborhood, that would come back in, and he would, like, give him, like, a pair of shower shoes and stuff like that. Like, that was his thing, how he paid it back, how he did amends. Anyway, so I'm thinking of all these guys, that guy crying, all the times I've seen inmates cry, all the times I've been in psychiatric hospitals where I saw people locked up who just lost their minds, you know, and kids waiting to see their fathers all these years. So anyway, the name of the poem is The Witness. I've been a witness to such pain, those crushed by life and left insane. I've watched so many inmates cry, held hands with friends I knew would die, saw children suffering for our choice, the innocent without a voice, the broken homes, the battered wives, the homeless living shattered lives, all victims of addiction's rage, trapped inside its hard cage. Yet I have also seen God save so many from an early grave, saw lives restored and filled with hope, the broken find a way to cope. Through steps inspired from above, they found their way back to God's love. So give the steps a chance, you'll see, they'll change you as they have changed me. And that's a culmination of a lot of years, man, just the experiences that we're talking about tonight, of the guys that, you know, that have impressed that stuff on my heart over the years, and all the different times when I've gone there and seen these little kids waiting to see their fathers, and all the guys who talked about being molested, and the guys who have AIDS, and the guys who are grateful that they're lifers, that you're talking about lifers, that were in there since before the AIDS epidemic, and they're thankful that they went to jail before the AIDS epidemic, because they know if they were on the outside, they'd be dead because of their addictions. To hear a guy who's doing life say that he's grateful, you know, is pretty intense. And that's what I'm saying about that commitment. Like, how could I possibly leave there and feel like going out and using, you know? It just doesn't even enter my mind. It's like if I saw a hammer laying on the table, I wouldn't think about picking it up and smashing myself in the face with it. If I see a set of works, or if I see, you know, in a doctor's office, or I see it, like, doesn't even enter my thought process to use, because I see all the pain. Like, you see the truth of addiction. Like, having had a spiritual awakening, you know, I couldn't see the consequences of my behavior. I couldn't see the lives that I hurt, you know. I just had a birthday. I just turned 65 on March 4th, and I think about, you know, the drugs I sold to people, the people that may have died, the guns I sold to dangerous people, you know, who may have killed somebody. I have to live with that for the rest of my life. How do I make amends? One night I was driving home from Greaterford, and I thought about this when I had about 7 years. And I thought about all the kids that I spent to bed crying because I had burglarized their house, you know. And I had been burglarized at this point around 3 times since I'd been in recovery. And my kids used to cry themselves asleep for months after that, you know. And I thought about all that pain. And at the same time, God put that thought in my head, like, you know, maybe somebody at that meeting tonight won't go out and do the same thing. Like, you can't change what you did. But maybe somebody there tonight won't do the same thing. That's the only way you can make amends, you know. And for some of us who did so much crime, I couldn't pay back for all the crime I did if I went to jail for the rest of my life, if I got convicted on every felony I committed. But the truth is that, you know, God gives us a way out of that. But I can, through indirectly doing, you know, being involved in this, He's freed me from a lot of that, that, you know, that guilt and that shame and that remorse for the things that I've done, you know, because I feel like I'm a part of something. I'm a part of His, you know, He can take all the crap in my life and use it as fertilizer, you know, if I put it in His hands. Absolutely. But in the meantime, you know, if I just keep it to myself, it just stinks up my life, continues to stink up my life, you know. But every time I put myself in His hands, I feel like I leave there and I'm transformed, even on like a physical level. Like I said, some of those days when I don't feel like going, I come out and I start to cry. And not only do I feel healed emotionally and spiritually, but physically I'm not sick. Like when I get there, I feel like I took poison and I have a migraine headache and I'm sick. because my exchanges haven't worked, you know, for a couple of days. And I'm like sick as a dog. And I come out of there and I'm physically well. I don't know how to explain it. I just know that a grateful addict will never use. And if you want to be grateful, you can't sit home and create the feeling of gratitude. You have to go out and act grateful. I don't always feel grateful because I'm a human being, but I can always act grateful. And by acting grateful, I can get the benefits of that, you know. And sometimes I do get that feeling where it makes me cry because I feel so full of gratitude and so blessed, you know, so part of something greater than myself.
That's really beautiful. And I wanted to just say about the poem too, that I really loved it. I really felt it. And, you know, even the name, I love that you named it, was it The Witness?
Yeah, The Witness.
The Witness, the idea that we bear witness for each other, and that even the word bear in that phrase, we bear witness, we carry each other via our witness of each other's experience and each other's pain, and that the powerful way that occurs inside of I can't even imagine it. A lifer who's in there for murder is doing hospice work. You want to talk about a powerhouse of a ninth step. I mean, how do you, you can't make that kind of stuff up, you know, and to bear witness to that and the stuff that happens with families. I spent my morning yesterday in a waiting room waiting to go see a guy who's locked up, and just sitting in the waiting room and watching the kids and the grandmas and the, you know, the people waiting to get in to see them, and you just realize how much the pain and suffering of addiction ripples outward. Just that much, the recovery process ripples outward. And so I just really want to acknowledge you for your life's work. Like, holy shit. I mean, you're in there with that kind of heart. It's really moving.
I appreciate it. But, you know, again, my last sponsor used to say that, you know, people used to say how much it meant to them, you know, that we would come in there and all. Used to say, we feel like we're stealing when we're here.
Exactly.
Like, you just have no idea. You know, people say, why do you go to meetings? Somebody, why do you still do that stuff after all them years? Because it's better. It's the best. Like I said earlier, if I could give that gift to anybody, to my own children or anybody, my grandchildren, not that I'd want them to be an addict, but if they could experience some of the experiences that I've had as being involved in the recovery process in NA, you know, and telling these guys, you know, that God loves them, that they're not, you know, as bad as things were, that bad as things happened to them when they were children, the environment they grew up in, all, but that God always loved them, you know what I mean? But, like, people hurt other people. That's just the way it is, you know, like, but God has nothing to do with that. That's not his will. That's, you know, other people's will. And sometimes other people's will interferes with our lives, and our will interferes with other people's lives. But God's will is always that we just stop hurting ourselves and stop hurting other people. That's all he really requires of us, man. And he loves us, you know, unconditionally. And so he either loves us unconditionally or else I've been living a lie all these years. You know, it's like you can't earn unconditional love. It just is. And so I feel when I'm in that position, I can feel his unconditional love coming through me and those guys. Sometimes I can sit in there and I almost hear, I know it sounds odd, but I can almost hear the God in them talking to me, you know, to the God in me. Like, I can almost hear them, you know, like God is locked up inside of there with them, in that prison with them, you know, inside them. So, I don't know. It's, I'm getting a little bit too deep with that, but I'm just saying it's an amazing experience. And, like, if you could, you know, it's sad to me because here's one of the things is, like, I go to Montgomery County Prison, for instance. They just instituted a new thing where you have to go through these orientations, which they do, like, every 3 or 4 months. They have one on the first Thursday of the month. So when they first started it, I had to go. And I went. And there was probably, I'm not exaggerating, 100 people there from AA. You know how many people there were there from NA? Two. Me and this other guy who used to be my sponsor. He lives in Florida now. That was it. That's all that showed up. So every week I go back there and I do that meeting every week, because if I don't go, they don't let them off the block. They lock them down for the whole night. Those guys, whether it's snowing, whether it's raining, whatever it is, that the guards will say, he ain't coming tonight. They'll say, yes, he is. Call up there. I call down to the, you know, by the, we're next to the chapel down in the basement. Say, call down there. You know, he's here. I know he's, we know he's here. And sure enough, you know, they'll come down. They'll let him down sometimes. Sometimes they won't. They'll keep him locked up. But they'll tell me the next week, you know, we told them you were going to be here. You know, we told them you were going to be here. And that's really the best.
Pete, I can address that a little bit. One of the ironies is that the county correctional facility, it's actually more difficult to get people in to come in as a volunteer for NA than it is the state. And their requirements are, if you've been on probation or incarcerated within the last 5 years, you don't get in. If your phone number shows up on any of their call logs for the last 5 years from within that prison, you don't get in.
And we had the same thing. It's the same thing at Graterford. That's why it's just, I got two guys that are cleared, me and one other guy. That's it. And that, because of the same thing, you can't have been incarcerated for 10 years.
Yeah, it's a real challenge, you know, everywhere in the world where these facilities have requirements, because addicts, by our nature, many of us are excluded from those facilities.
Well, that's the thing about AA. See, AA is, you know, alcohol, unless you get a DUI, it's really not a crime. Where people in our life, you know, you're committing crimes every day. In order to be an addict, you have to commit a crime every day. So that's a big part of it. The other part of it is people just, I don't know what it is. I'll tell you, I wonder sometimes. I just think, well, one of the things that they've changed a lot of that stuff, like when I first started, I could call up a guy, I could call your name in today and take you in tonight. That was it. Like, I just had to tell them your name. And if I vouch for you, they let you in. Now it's like you have to fill out paperwork. It has to go to Harrisburg. When it comes back from Harrisburg, then it comes back there, say, for instance, to Graterford. They only have an orientation once every 6 months. So by the time the paperwork comes back, that takes a couple of months, a few months. And then once it comes back, then they schedule you for an orientation. But if you have something else going on that night, like one of the guys just had a thing with his daughter at her high school, he couldn't make it. The guy that was going to take over the Spanish meeting, he couldn't make it. So he's put off for another 6 months. And then people will say, well, you know, maybe it's just not God's will that I get involved. You know, they just lose interest. And that's the sad part.
All right. Well, we are about at the
hour. Out of time?
Well, I wouldn't say out of time, but we're about at the hour point, and I just kind of want to wrap it up. I just want to say to you, you know, I really feel your heart. I feel your commitment, and I feel a real kinship with the kind of stuff that you shared here today, and I think a lot of people will. So, you know, and I get too, like when I say to you, you know, I really want to acknowledge your service, and you resisted a little bit, and I get that. You know, there's a principle there. The principle being, we get if you knew how much I got from what I'm doing, you know, it's. I don't know. It's that sort of paradox. People say it's a selfish program. I don't like that expression, but I understand it. You know, because I don't think what you're doing is selfish in any way, shape, or form. But what you're doing is giving you benefit that is probably greater than, you know, you could anyone in there. So, you know, I don't know. I just want to tell you, I really get you. I really feel it, and I respect so much what you're doing. That's a long commitment.
Well, yeah, Pete, you know how much I think of you, and I've seen your commitment for a very long time, and I've been in meetings where people put their hand up and they just got out, and they talk about how they heard the message, and it was Petey bringing them the message, either at the county facility or up at Graterford. And I know you're a very humble guy, but It's great work that you do. Albuquerque's blessed to have someone like you that we just interviewed the other day, who's deeply involved in taking the message into the incarcerated folks. So, you know, thank you for your service, buddy.
Thank you, David. Thanks, Ron. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I just hope that, you know, it's just not about me, you know, that people will take this to their heart. And like my second sponsor used to say, you know, just feel what it feels like, if they could look into my heart and see what it feels like and maybe want that for themselves, you know, and get involved in service. That's the key. That's always been the way since the very beginning. You have the Mother Fellowship. It was like two guys got together and then they went and visited another third guy in the hospital and got it. That's how the whole thing started. You know what I mean? I remember there's an old story about Bill W's wife telling his wife when he had about 6 months, I'm giving this up. You know, not one of these guys I've been trying to help has stayed sober. And his wife said, Bill, you haven't drank for 6 months. You know, and that's the key. That's always been the key, you know, and we borrowed everything from the Mother Fellowship.
Yes.
And that's something we should always remember, that we owe them a great debt of gratitude, like it says in the beginning of the basic text, you know, that we do. Those guys that were, not everybody wanted me around, but there was enough guys that I see these gentlemen, and I wanted to be like them at that point in my life. I was just a wild 30-year-old, but I wanted to be like those guys.
It makes me think of a line from the big book, where in the Working with Others chapter, it starts out something like, nothing will so ensure immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics.
And there you go. Basically. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I think it's a shame, because a lot of people, you know, we came in at a time where people think, oh, it was rough because you didn't have this stuff or you didn't have. But I think we were exposed to a lot of stuff that a lot of people aren't exposed to today. You know, a lot of wisdom. And there were people that were, you know, the kindness and just those sort of lessons like that. You know, if you're, whatever your problem is, if you throw yourself into service, your problem will work itself out.
Yeah, and each one of us will find our own place in service. It might be H&I, it might be PR, it might be phone lines, it might be activities. You know, it could be any number of things like that. But being of service. So that's the other thing I was thinking of as you were sharing. Is that another one to acknowledge is all of those guys that are out there that hear your voice and recognize themselves. I mean, there's an army. We have an expression in NA, the H&I kind of guy. There's an army of people out there showing up every week at these facilities, and it's a powerful force out there to have you guys, to have everybody doing that kind of service. And then those people answering the phones, you know, taking those phone calls. You get, how many phone calls do you get that are not even really appropriate for NA that you're fielding? And then you get that one. There it is. There's that one, that addict calling. And it's been worth weeding through everything you've been talking through to get to that addict. And then, you know, maybe seeing that person at a meeting. And so NA service is a pretty powerful gift. And,
you know, it's always struck me. I've taken to saying that the roots of NA lie in prison. If you look at the birth of Addicts Anonymous down in Lexington, the first meeting of the New York Fellowship was at the Women's House of Detention in New York. We know that in the earliest days on the West Coast, that meetings were taken into prisons. So it just seems so appropriate that a fellowship that was born in prison is focused through people like Pete and taking the message back constantly, because that's where addicts are.
That's where we end up. Jails, institutions, and death.
Yeah. That's, well, great. Okay. All right. Well, let's call it. I really want to thank you for taking the time, Pete. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you, and thanks for everything you do.
I hope to see you sometime.
Okay.
David can bring you. You can get to one of our home group meetings.
All right,
Dave. He's been there.
Oh, okay.
He was there for the anniversary.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah. Yeah. You were in the room, weren't you, Pete?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
We might even have met, I think, that day, but, you know, you don't have any frame of reference for it at the time. Right. But next time we will. So I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, all right. You
too. All right. See you, Dave.
David, I'll see you maybe Monday, all right?
Tuesday's the anniversary meeting down the mall.
You know what I got? Montgomery County Prison, man. I have to miss it every year. I'm the only one. If I don't go, they don't let them off the block. You know?
All right, buddy. I'll see you soon.
See you guys.
All right, bro. Love you.